The Guardian.
What episode is this? Seven? Lockdown seven?
I think you said last one was seven.
Did I say seven or six?
Maybe it's eight. Does it matter?
What, does anything matter? Hello, and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Lockdown episode 6, 7, or 8. We're not quite sure which one it is. Hey, Barry, how are you?
Hi, how's things?
Yeah, not bad. Do you want some feedback?
I'm here all alone in my isolation bunker, so yes, any feedback is welcome. It is, of course, positive, I trust.
Carl's is nice. Thanks for keeping these coming. I'd be overcooking it if I said it was keeping me sane. But it is familiarity that is welcome in these times, says Carl. Derek says, my wife was wondering who the engaging, affable Irishman was on the pod. Turns out she was talking about Lars. So, and Barry, you were really engaged by a tweet from Darren Riley that took a screen grab of the Irish Times. 50 podcasts you need to listen to right now. Do you want me to read you the Football Weekly part?
Please do, yes.
It says, Football Weekly. When James Richardson left the Guardian's Football Weekly, many feared it would rip the beating heart from the show. It didn't. New host Max Rushton has been doing a bang-up job, striking just the right puns and punditry chord fans have come to expect. Do you feel there was anything missing from that particular bit of praise for the podcast from an Irish journal?
Well, far be it from me to criticised the paper of record in any way, but I feel I should have deserved at least a passing mention, considering I am the glue that holds this podcast together. But I will say, at least we got a recommendation from the Irish Times. When the Observer ran a similar list, they didn't deign to mention us at all. So, thanks in part to the Irish Times, but next time, yeah, just remember who the brains behind this operation is, and it ain't Max.
Hey, below the line, Soccer Mum said, as your awesome guest podders have aired their past, I would love Max and Barry to share how they ended up here. Barry, when are we going to do a deep dive into your life, and are you going to get Jimbo back to interview me?
I would rather not do a deep dive into my life. I've done one before for the Irishman Abroad podcast, which I can't recommend highly enough for anyone who's looking for something to listen to. And I found it to be a deeply uncomfortable experience and one I'm never going to repeat. I personally find it a bit self-indulgent. But I'm, having said that, I found Philippe's and Lars's both fascinating, and Sid's.
Paul says, Barry reciting Scatman made my day. I was out for a walk listening to the pod. I was laughing so much I had to stop. What a day, what a man, what a pod. And Colin says, hi Max, I finally got around to making a monthly contribution to The Guardian. It wasn't the wit of Marina Hyde, the investigative diligence of David Conn, or even the endless output from the pod, but a misanthropic Irishman discrediting a 99-year-old war veteran that convinced me. So well done, Barry. It worked.
Oh, good. Did he contribute £20 million? Did we beat the 99-year-old?
Well, here's hoping. If you want us to get to £23 million, guardian.com/support podcasts. Thank you so much. Right. We'll get on with part two in just a second. The 1991 FIFA World Championship for Women's Football, USA 2, Norway 1, with Susie Rack and Flo Lloyd Hughes. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's introduce the panel for today. Susie Rack, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Now, we did a Google Hangout with you yesterday and we noticed there is a massive drum kit behind you. Is it good being stuck in a house 24 hours a day, or 23 hours a day, if you're being sensible, with a drum kit?
Not when there's a six-year-old on the end of the sticks, and it's based in my office. But luckily, he kind of is quite short in his practices, at least.
Okay. Is there a chance that he'll come into the pod and just play some swing for us?
Swing would be a stretch. He can just about hold a beat.
Ideally, I would like him to play us out with a big, long Keith Moon solo.
Flo Lloyd Hughes, how are you?
I'm okay, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thanks. I noticed on Twitter that you spent 3.5 hours doing your boyfriend's hair.
I spent 6 hours in total. We finished at the end.
Six hours?
Yeah, it was a very long process. And his hair looks pretty raggedy. But luckily, he's not going anywhere, so I don't have to be embarrassed. And I've said if he goes to the shops, he has to put a hat on so that I'm not associated with the hair. I'm going to give it another go later this week, and we're going to try again. We were doing cornrows, and it's quite a technical hairstyle. And
sure.
I'm the worst person to do that sort of thing because I get my hair cut once, maybe twice a year. I wear little to no makeup and I'm not very invested in hair and beauty. So of all the people to be asked to do some hair, not the one.
Flo, when lockdown is over, will you cornrow Barry?
I would be honoured. I would be honoured.
Right, let's get on with the game. The 1991 FIFA World Championship for Women's Football for the M&M's Cup, USA 2, Norway 1 in Guangdong in China. The first unofficial Women's World Tournament was in Italy in 1970. What happened between 1970 and the game we watched yesterday?
It's interesting because it took a while to get to this point, really, obviously 20 years, but I'm sure that a lot of listeners have watched some of the documentaries that have been on Channel 4, BBC over the last couple of years, which really showed how popular women's football was around the world wars because of the role that women played during that time. And obviously, most people know about the 50-year ban that the FA placed on women's football in England specifically, but The history of women's football is really interesting. And if any of the listeners want to find out more, there's lots of great books out there. But yeah, it took a while to get to this point because of the ban and other countries sort of progressing in different ways. And FIFA hadn't yet taken on responsibility for women's football. It actually took a long time before they absorbed that into their control internationally. So you had this tournament in 1970 and tournament in 1971, which were sort of the unofficial World Cups, as it were. There weren't a lot of teams playing in them, but they were very well attended. The 1971 tournament in Mexico had over 100,000 people going to one of the games. So much like we talk about, you know, some of those Ditka ladies games getting, you know, 80,000 people. It was a similar thing. So women's football was really popular and people were interested in it, but it hadn't quite yet, been on FIFA's radar, or they weren't interested in organising it, and neither were some of the national associations. And it wasn't until FIFA sent out this survey, which literally was a survey. It was basically a kind of two-pager that they sent to all their member associations to basically say, hey, what are you guys doing? This was in 1970. What are you guys doing about women's football? Is it on your radar? So there were 135 associations, 90 replied, 12 said, yeah, we recognize it, but we don't necessarily run the national team, France being one of those. So they kind of thought, okay, still not massive interest, but we'll start looking into this. And then kind of fast forward to 1986, and there was a Congress, the FIFA Congress, going alongside the World Cup, the Men's World Cup in Mexico. And there was a Norwegian delegate called Ellie Willey, who basically said, stood up in the Congress and said, look, this is ridiculous. You've got, I don't know, 200 pages of documents here, and there's not one mention of women's football. This is ridiculous. So after that, they sort of thought, oh, okay, you know, she's right, actually. There's obviously interest here, and we need to start looking into things. And that's when FIFA did start to take a bit more of interest. They created a committee. And then from there, we saw the development of a kind of a precursor to this World Cup in China, which was a bit of a test event, which took place in the same area and was organised by the Chinese FA. And a lot of the same teams that came to the World Cup in 91 also attended that tournament. So in 1991, we finally see this sort of official badge, and ISL, the now sort of defunct marketing agency that ended up in a lot of scandal because of bribery. They actually helped organize this World Cup, which is why it's got, you know, ridiculous sponsors and was called the M&M World Cup or what. I know, Barry, you've got the official title. It's, I can't remember what it is. It's the...
The official title is the FIFA's Women's World Championship for the M&M Cup, which is sort of a none too subtle nod to Mars.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the planet, the confectionery company of the same name.
So in 91 then, what sort of interest was there for this tournament?
Very, very little. Like in terms of kind of big scale kind of promotion and interest in countries outside of China. I mean, even in China, they had to draft in workers from some of the factories to fill some of the stadiums just to kind of make it look good. Because I think like it, whilst they had had the test event in 1988 ahead of this, they really wanted to use the 1991 tournament as like a bit of a we can host major tournaments, we're bidding for the Olympics, that's what we want, this is our chance to prove that we can do it. And there was a big battle to get the FIFA branding onto this tournament, and the fact that it had that stupid ridiculous long name was an indication of how reluctant FIFA were to hand over the World Cup brands, like the pomposity and arrogance of that they sort of couldn't risk their brand on women's football because it was so unpopular, and they didn't want to like kind of necessarily throw all their eggs into the basket just yet. Like just kind of reeks of the complete kind of blind arrogance of the body as a whole. Outside of the likes of Germany and Scandinavia, women's football was not big. The US, it had only been going 5 years before that tournament on an international level. So, yeah, I mean, England were very, very low-key, didn't make that competition. So, I mean, you're talking very, very limited fan base worldwide.
Something that I had no idea about, literally until we started watching it yesterday, was it wasn't even 90 minutes, the game.
Yeah, before the tournament, FIFA decided that the matches should be 80 minutes in length because the poor little ladies might struggle to run around for an entire 90. And this decision prompted the USA captain, April Heinrichs, to make a comment along the lines that they must be worried our ovaries will fall out if we have to play 90 minutes. They also toyed with the idea of using a smaller, lighter football, but that was vetoed following a protest by the players because it would have meant them playing with footballs they weren't used to playing with, which obviously wouldn't be ideal. And it's kind of a measure of how, well, obviously the players were amateurs, but the USA, who were the eventual winners of the match, they beat Norway 2-1. They had a 36-hour journey, I think 5 different flights, to get to their base in China, and they were all getting by on $10 a day per diems. So, you know, it wasn't a particularly lucrative exercise for anyone involved.
I would definitely pay money to watch an entire World Cup played with a shoot size 5 from a petrol station, a little plastic ball that curls the other way. The game itself, this was a message from Chris Vokes from The Sportsman saying, "This was women's football without its own identity, no real structure or rhythm, nobody seemingly playing to their strengths. Highlights just how far the game has come in the intervening years, or maybe it was just another shit World Cup final." Susie, you were saying during the game yesterday that the American women of that era kind of struggled because the men's team wasn't up to much. The year before this, they'd gone out of Italia 90 in the group stages, losing all 3 games. How did the men's team affect the women's?
Yeah, so they didn't have a real, like, kind of football ethos to fall back on in the same way that women's teams kind of in Italy kind of can look to the way the men's team played, the style of Italian football, and sort of mimic it, or, you know, the way England could slot in and pick up on the England DNA type stuff of the past. Like the US just does not have that history or identity in men's football, so they were essentially kind of picking up with a blank slate with the women's. So when Anson Durant, who was the manager, kind of picked up the team, he was then the head coach of the University of North Carolina women's team, and he's still head coach of that team. today has got the record for NCAA championships. And he basically kind of rewrote the script a little bit and stuck three up top, which the I think it was the Chinese press labelled them the triple-edged sword of Karen Jennings, Michelle Akers, and who's the third?
April Heinrichs.
That's it. And that was a new strategy. You know, yes, playing 4-3-3 in 91 was not necessarily the done thing. Norway ended up doing similar in the final. They pressed hard and fast and played to the strength that they had, which was the fact that they had all these young college players playing full-time football meant that they had good athletes, if not any kind of football identity or strategy behind them. So they played to their strength, which was push hard, play fast, and a really, really run at teams, basically.
It's probably worth mentioning as well, Max, that the American team definitely, and presumably the Norwegians as well, had played six matches each in very hot conditions in the 2 weeks of the tournament. So fatigue may well have been a factor. And they also weren't eating particularly well, healthily, because the Americans certainly didn't take to the local cuisine. So I think they were living on a staple diet of sponsors' products and sort of peanut butter sandwiches, which, while very nice, aren't the ideal sort of food to be eating in preparation for massive physical exertion.
What was the story about a team sharing its pasta with another team?
Yeah, so they drafted in, this is in The Making of the Women's World Cup, a really great book that came out last year by Kieran Taven and Jeff Kazouf, which talks about the fact that the US drafted in family members to cook for them. And because of these invitational tournaments previously, they already knew that they didn't want to eat the local food, and they'd found things like worms in their broccoli, and they weren't obviously drinking the tap water. So to combat that this time around for the official tournament, they drafted in some family members to cook for them, and they just basically ate pasta. And then there was this story of Sweden asking if they could also have some of the pasta, but USA were about to play Sweden. So there was this whole dilemma of, well, do we give them our pasta? Because, you know, is it going to gain them a competitive advantage? But like Barry was saying, they would, you know, before that, they were just eating Mars bars and drinking Gatorade because that's all they knew. And they were quite, you know, suspicious of the local cuisine.
Also, the tournament coincided with Thanksgiving Day. So the Americans sourced a turkey somewhere. And they had turkey with as many as the trimmings as they could find for Thanksgiving, and were joined by Pele for the celebration. And he also was introduced to the players before the final and presented the medals afterwards.
Now, the star of the game, you mentioned her, was Michelle Akers, Susie. Her first goal is actually an absolutely brilliant header. It also, what sort of hilariously, won American Airlines Play of the Game. But it was a brilliant header, and she was the star of this game, Susie.
Yeah, she was star of the game, star of the tournament, really. I mean, she scored 10 goals across the tournament. She got 5 against Chinese Taipei in the quarterfinals. And in the context of a kind of career after that, she scored another 2 World Cup goals. So, I mean, yeah, she really kind of stamped her mark on the game. And I think it was at halftime when it was 1-1 that one of the coaches said to her that she's going to have to win this game, and then went out and really took it by the scruff of the neck and kind of drove the team forward. So, yes, a hugely influential player and kind of still very, very involved in women's football now as well, which is great. So many of this team have kind of carried on their legacy from that day.
That is quite interesting that this team that won this first tournament have all become, not all of them, but a lot of them become sort of pioneers.
Yeah, I mean, you go through them. The goalkeeper, Mary Harvey, who was perhaps at fault for the Norway goal, if not a little bit blocked by defender. She's director or chief exec of the Centre for Sports and Human Rights. April Heinrichs, the other one of the front three. She, until the start of 2019, was the youth women's national team director. Linda Hamilton, head coach of Southwestern University now. Mia Hamm, co-owner of LAFC, an ambassador for Barcelona, on the board of directors of Roma, Julie Faldi, big broadcaster. But then again, all of them are like massive advocates for women's football as well. You often hear of, you know, Julie Faldi or Bea Hamm or Joy Fawcett speaking at various events and using their platform to promote the game.
It's quite interesting, actually, that so many of them went on to do, to such great things, because when this match was played, I mean, pretty much nobody in the States knew it was even on. I think it was only broadcast by one local cable channel somewhere. And when they arrived home, there was nobody really to greet them at the airport. They didn't get a big reception. I think there may have been one or two journalists, and then the rest were just family members who came out to greet them. So they clearly did start something.
It was the 99 World Cup which probably provided a bit more of an impetus for them to create that legacy, because after the 99ers, as they were called, and obviously the famous penalty shootout with Brandy Chastain and that celebration and the Sports Illustrated cover and all these things that came with it, that was really the defining moment. And the 91 World Cup was kind of like the first step on that journey. And it wasn't really until the 99ers came that everything sort of changed. And so many of that team went on to play in three World Cups for the USA. And I think they were also really not concerned, but really wanted to give back and realize that interest and hosting that World Cup in 99, there was so much pressure and they had to continue that legacy.
Flo, we talked a lot about the technical advances in women's football. And so when I turned this on yesterday, I just had no idea if I was going to watch a really brilliant game or just 22 hopeless footballers. And actually, I thought the pace of the game seemed, especially since how much football they'd played in such a short period and what they were eating, I thought the pace of the game seemed pretty similar, actually, to what we see now, if technically not at the same level.
Yeah, I was the same, Max, because I've never watched that game. I've watched the 99 final a lot because that's such a famous kind of cult classic, but I'd never watched that game. And I was really surprised as well. I mean, it was pretty kind of choppy and a bit kind of clumsy in parts. There were a lot of kind of dodgy tackles, a lot of foul throws, but I mean,
an amazing foul throw, one of the best foul throws I've literally bounced on. It was amazing,
but I still complain week in week out about foul throws in professional football, so not much has changed there. But one of those was particularly bad. Some very dodgy hair, but yeah, on the pitch, you know, it was actually much better than I thought. And I think, you know, what Susie mentioned about the fact that America were playing such an aggressive style with three players up front meant that it was much, you know, it was quite high pressing. It was quite fast paced. And I think if we'd seen two European teams playing in that final, it probably would have been a lot slower, a bit pedestrian, a bit more, you know, trying to play it out from the back, a bit more of kind of a thinking man's game. And it probably would have been a completely different final. But I think America's aggressive kind of arrogant style, which they, you know, was self-made, that helped make it into actually, you know, an entertaining game.
I'd wonder whether the 99 World Cup would have been as impactful if we hadn't have had this and the US winning it. So in that sense, like, as a trigger for accelerating the growth in the States and making 99 as big as it was, I'd say it was key from that point of view.
Did they get a load of M&Ms, or did they have to hug that giant M&M a lot? I mean, I know, as the voice of Gaviscon, I don't get given any free Gaviscon. Not that I need it. I mean, I'd give it to you, Barry, surely. But do we know what did we? Are there any awkward shots of them hugging that giant M&M, or is the giant M&M man a construct of the 21st century?
I didn't see any hugging. I did see there was a slightly awkward post-match interview with Michelle Akers, but I didn't see any, you know, Super Bowl style, you're going to Disneyland or you're going to M&M World. It was quite low key. I'm not exactly sure how much they got in terms of prize money, but seeing as they were, you know, given $10 per diems, I imagine it was zero, or, you know, because they were mostly amateurs or all amateurs, I think. They were probably not given any prize money. It was just, you know, you're doing it for the love of the game. So maybe a hug from Mr. Eminem was kind of the best you were going to get.
I think the best prize was the Germans who won the first women's Euros and were given tea sets by the Federation.
That's amazing. All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll begin with the impact of COVID-19 on the women's game. We'll discuss any other business. And of course, chapter five of Detective Wilson. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. FIFPro have warned last week the women's game is particularly poorly placed to weather the economic downturn, which looks likely to come from this pandemic crisis. They say the lack of written contracts, the short-term duration of employment contracts, the lack of health insurance and medical coverage, and the absence of basic worker protections and workers' rights leaves many female players, and some of whom are already teetering on the margins, at great risk of losing their livelihoods. And the fear, I guess, Susie, is that all the good work done to advance women's football in the last few years may be lost.
It could be devastatingly bad for women's football, this crisis. Like, the FIFA report is really, really great because they highlight the fact that, you know, like, often at times like this, there's a tendency to look at where the biggest amount of damage will be done, which is the Premier League, but and kind of professional men's football. But the reality is that ones that are going to be worst affected are the ones kind of like very much on the fringes financially, and women's football is still very much at that stage. So that's why it's going to struggle so much. So many of these clubs are kind of teetering on the brink of existence anyway, like in a constant battle to survive. You know, we've had clubs fold in recent years anyway, and there's not really any kind of base for them to fall back on. It's, I kind of like think about it a bit more broadly, like in wider society, if things go to pot a bit, the government could fall back on the welfare state. There's no welfare state to prop up women's football or football generally, really, unless you start dipping into the big pots of money and FIFA and stuff. And I just have this big fear, and FIFPro have said it in their report, that we're not only going to see clubs struggle on the basis of what they're already existing on, but also some of the funding that's been promised to clubs from the likes of UEFA, from parent clubs, from the FA, from FIFA, we're going to start seeing the money that was promised them be revoked as well, and have those decisions reversed a little bit as they try and deal with the fallout on the men's side in particular. Yeah, so it could be devastatingly bad.
And what this whole crisis has shown is, even in the top tier, clubs are living hand to mouth. And if the men's clubs are living hand to mouth, then the women's club are living hand to mouth, mouth to hand, if that makes sense. So they're relying on that financial support from the parent men's club. And if that, you know, no longer exists because they can't provide it, or because the men's club doesn't exist, well, then there's no chance the women's club is going to exist. And we've seen clubs like London City Lionesses trying to pop up to try and show that, you know, women's clubs can grow and be sustainable on their own without that support. So perhaps this is going to see the birth of more things like that, because the men's teams will say, I'm sorry, that budget that we were going to give you for 2021 season is now, you know, halved. Maybe we'll see more people step in and potentially detach themselves and try and go it alone. I think we'll still see clubs like Chelsea dominate because they're so determined to dominate that I don't think this is going to put them off. And, you know, they've already shown with what they've been doing outside of on the pitch with their partnership with Refuge and things like that, that they're very determined to come out of this crisis on a positive note. But I think we may see the kind of smaller women's clubs, even if they are attached to a men's team, you know, Spurs, for example, a lot of their financial woes from this crisis have been aired out in the public, one of them being the massive naming rights deal that they were hoping to get for Spurs Stadium, which now isn't going to happen. So it's teams like that which could struggle to still obtain the same support that they were getting, you know, 6 months ago.
Now, the Premier League clubs had a conference call on Friday to discuss the letter sent by UEFA to all domestic associations asking for them to plan to complete their competitions by the 31st of July. This would allow them to use August to complete the Champions League and the Europa League, playing a game every 3 days. Thanks to reporting from Paul Ballas and Jamie Jackson in the paper, we understand the hypothetical best case scenario they came up with was clubs would be given 3 to 4 weeks for a kind of pre-season to give the players time to regain fitness starting on either the 10th or the 14th of May. The games would be played behind closed doors starting the weekend of the 13th and 14th of June. All players, club staff, official security and media present would have to be tested, and the NHS will have power of veto for any restart. There's also a worst case scenario, which is that football may not be able to be restarted until October. And the EFL chair, Rick Parry, has written an open letter to supporters to warn that whenever the next games take place, they will almost certainly be played without crowds. Barry, on Thursday, you were very cynical about this idea of the best case scenario. I guess they have to have a best case scenario, even if that best case scenario is unrealistic.
I think it's unfair to say I was cynical. I think I was realistic. And I appreciate they have to plan and have to... If this is the plan they've come up with, grand. But I would imagine, in my far from expert opinion, that even October is an optimistic shout. I certainly can't envisage any games being played, I mean, before the end of the summer, really. I just think it's so impractical and it's so much work involved, even to play them behind closed doors, that... personally, I would be astonished if there's any football played before the end of the summer.
Arsenal are set to take a 12.5% wage cut. They'll be reimbursed if they reach the Champions League. Watford's players are close to agreeing wage deferrals. Roma, players and coaching staff won't be taking a salary from March to June and will personally top up wages of other club employees who have been furloughed. Quite extraordinary lengths that they're going to. Gazzetta dello Sport, talking of Italy, have published a leaked document which detailed the proposed protocol for Serie A clubs to begin training again, which is as follows. 3 to 4 days before training begins, players and staff will undergo medical tests one by one. Blood tests and swabs every day for the first week to determine which players have had the virus already and may now be immune. Players then divided into three groups, those who've had the virus with serious symptoms, those who've had the virus with minor or no symptoms, and those who haven't had it. After training has begun, they'll stay in a hotel or a training ground to avoid potential contamination. Those who've had the virus already will undergo intensive medical testing, wearing heart monitors 24/7 and having CAT scans of their torsos. For the first 14 days, all players must remain a minimum of 2 meters apart while training, eating or changing. After 14 days of training, they will then be allowed to train together. Physios will wear protective clothing, masks, gloves and a face shield. And any player they are treating will need to wear a mask too. When travelling between hotel and training ground, everyone must wear masks and gloves.
What you're saying there is what would need to happen for football to start being played behind closed doors in June. And that's just the players and training staff and physio staff you're talking about. If you're playing games behind closed doors, you also have to include TV production staff and commentators and catering staff wherever they're staying. So, you know, it's... It's far from an easy job to get those games going, you know, even if there's no crowds.
On a slightly lighter note, FC Midtjylland, currently 12 points clear at the top of the Danish Superliga, have installed giant screens in the car parks outside their stadium so that when the league restarts, and in all likelihood behind closed doors, fans will be able to watch it from their cars like a drive-in movie, and they'll be able to pick up TV commentary over their radios, just like America in the 50s. That's so exciting. Obviously, you just hope people don't get out of their car. You know, there are issues there, aren't there? What do you do with toilets? Or does it just everyone has to... Is it like builders in cranes? You have to just take in a big plastic bottle. Producer Jonathan tells me they have thought of toilets. The driver has to flash their lights. Flashing your lights in a car park is risky, isn't it? They will then be led to the toilets. Okay. It will then be professionally cleaned afterwards. I mean, you'd hope so, wouldn't you? So anyway, at least it's a positive story. Anyway, we'll obviously keep you posted on how football plans to come back every which way. You will have heard the sad news of Norman Hunter passing away at the age of 76 after contracting COVID-19. He was a member of the 1966 squad, another one of those who didn't play in the final, eventually got his winner's medal in 2009. Famously nicknamed Bite Your Legs, Don Revie praised him so much that wasn't Norman Hunter marvellous turned into something of a catchphrase for him. He was really remembered for tackling and being a pretty brutish player, famously sent off along with Franny Lee for that amazing brawl that you may have seen on YouTube. But he played an extraordinary number of times for Leeds United, 726, scored 21 goals, winning two First Division titles, one Second Division title, one FA Cup, a Charity Shield, two Intercities Fairs Cups. He was the first ever PFA Players Player of the Year in 73-74, got 28 England caps. And I don't know, Barry, how much you knew about him before or how much you've read about him since, but by all accounts, an absolutely lovely man as well off the pitch.
Well, I didn't see him play very often. In fact, the only game I've seen him play from start to finish was the 73 FA Cup final when Sunderland beat Leeds. So it's probably not a game he remembered very particularly fondly. But he had a reputation as a hard man. But from what I've read and heard over the weekend since his death, he was also a very good player and an absolute gentleman, as you say. James Brown, who is, you know, sort of celeb Leeds fan, gave a very, very, very moving tribute to him on TalkSport, which almost had me in tears. So hats off to him for that. And yeah, it's an awful shame that he's fallen victim to the virus. And yeah, I didn't see enough of him playing to be able to pass comment. But if he was voted by his peers to be the first player of the year, then he must have been pretty good.
Yeah, also played for Bristol City and Barnsley, and then he went on to have quite a long career in local radio especially, and hearing, I think it was Bryn Law, who went on to Sky, and Ian Dennis, who's at Five Live, both were the commentator, and local radio commentary teams are quite you're together for a long time, and you know, it's not a particularly glamorous gig, and they just said that he was an absolute gentleman and just great, great company. And I think that means a lot when you are traveling with someone for hours and hours in the same car, then doing the game, then hours and hours in the same car home. So obviously our thoughts are with all his friends and family. A completely different story about Dixon Atuhu, a former Man City, Preston, Sunderland, Fulham midfielder, has been banned from football in Sweden for 5 years. He was found guilty in November of match fixing, having offered AIK goalkeeper Kyriakos Stamatopoulos the equivalent of £160,000 to throw a game against IFK Gothenburg in 2017. Stamatopoulos refused, reported the behaviour, and the game was postponed. Atuhu was fined and sentenced to serve probation by the courts, with both prosecution and defence appealing the sentence. I mean, it's an extraordinary story because we just don't hear about match fixing a lot in football, I think.
Yeah, it's a weird story. I mean, it's a career ender for him because he's 37, so that's that. But silly boy.
Here's a question from Garth. Rumours circulating on the dark web suggest COVID-19 was developed by Flo in order to stop Leeds getting promotion. Any truth in this, Flo?
Well, the fact that I got a D in GCSE biology probably means that I do not have the knowledge or know-how on that one. But I commend his work. No, nothing to do with me.
Now, on the subject of Lars Sivertsen's pod, Harp said, I loved the show today. We were discussing, you know, foreign owners. He says, I now find myself obsessed with the alternative reality where Idi Amin bought Luton Town. We were also discussing a potential footballer, a euphonium player, footballer. You need to be stocky and skillful. And John pointed out that none of us came up with Jerdan Shaqiri, who's the absolute ultimate of stocky, skillful players. Now, Detective Wilson, Chapter 5, An Afternoon Ramble. Wilson's mind was a maelstrom of questions without any answers. The bloody note with his initials, his stolen award, putting him at the scene, Sam's clandestine meeting with the Ramble boys just before he died. So many pieces of the puzzle, but like post-Fergie Man U, none of them quite fit together. He couldn't find the pattern in play, the winning formation, the key to unlocking a defence. He'd been out of the game for too long. He wasn't match fit. Not yet, at least. The sound of his phone ringing pulled him away from his mental whiteboard. It was Ellis. John, I found one and followed him to the kick bar in Shoreditch. Wilson had sent the PI to track down the Ramble boys after seeing them on the CCTV at Webster's bar. Which one? Wilson inquired. The skinny Geordie fella with the tattoos. Do you want me to sit on him till you get here? The Welshman asked. Nah, I'll handle him. You head over to the Mundial offices. See if you can find anything, said Wilson. Gotcha. I'll keep you posted. Oh, and John, it's good working with you again. Just like old times. He hung up the phone. The hard-boiled detective wasn't one for sentimentality, but he knew deep down that he was glad to have Ellis on his team. So far, his wildcard signing had really paid off. He headed to Shoreditch to confront the Ramble boys. If you needed a job done that was, let's say, outside of the laws of the game, you went to them. Donaldson handled tech, Campbell was the face, and Moore was the muscle. All three of them worked under the management of Marcus Speller. There were a few people in Kick Bar when he walked through the door. He spotted the wiry Geordie with his head down, glued to his laptop. He had him cornered, and there was only one exit. Wilson smiled to himself. This was almost too easy. He approached the table, but as he crossed the room, the other punters got to their feet and headed for the exit. It felt like the Emirates in the 81st minute. What the hell was going on? He glanced over at the barman, who gave him a wink and then let himself out, locking the door behind him. Wilson had walked straight into a trap. Donaldson looked up from his computer, gave him an eerie grin and started to sing, "Mind the gap, mind the gap." As a Sunderland fan, Wilson got the reference. The Geordie had got one over on him. Before he had time to assess the situation, a door at the back of the bar opened and the rest of Donaldson's motley crew emerged. "Detective Wilson, ruddy good to see you," came the friendly, booming voice of Marcus Speller. Wilson looked around, planning an exit strategy. Moore immediately read his intentions. I wouldn't do that if I were you. Take a seat. I'd rather not, Wilson responded. It wasn't a fucking request, Moore spat back. The veteran detective acquiesced. Now, to what do we owe this pleasure? Speller asked genially. I was just in the neighbourhood, lied Wilson. Jim Campbell burst out laughing. Don't bullshit us, John. This is our bread and butter. Pete clocked your PI friend marking him out about an hour ago. Ice ran through Wilson's veins. His fears were justified. He was rusty. The detective managed to keep his cool. You boys are awfully jovial, considering you were the last people seen with a dead man. An air of unease swept the room. Campbell tried to play it off. What makes you think we were with the Mundial kid? The whole room took an in-breath. Campbell had just done a Gerrard slip and Wilson was through on goal. I didn't say who had died, Jim, he replied coldly. Campbell glanced at Speller, whose face was one of barely contained rage. A picture of latter-day Mourinho. The Ramblers looked stunned. Speller composed himself. What do you want? I want to know what your meeting was about, the detective said firmly. He tried to sign us on a short-term loan deal, just beefing up his defence, Marcus admitted. The kid thought he was being followed. He wanted protection, and considering what happened, I wager he was bloody right. Did he mention why? Pressed Wilson. Moore fielded this one. He said he'd stumbled across something big. And he wanted a bit of protection to see the game out. Finally, he was getting somewhere on the case. He pushed on. What happened after that? Marcus shrugged. We signed on the dotted line, took the job. Wilson delivered the finishing blow. Then you lost your man at the crucial moment. Speller sighed. We put a tracker on his phone at the meeting and we were meant to start proper the next day. Wilson's eyes widened. Marcus, Sam's phone was missing when they examined the body. I think the killer took it. Speller got the drift and gave Donaldson the nod. Immediately the Geordie started punching furiously at his keyboard. Right, it's showing that the phone is somewhere in Richmond. Richmond. A feeling of dread started to unfurl in the pit of Wilson's stomach. Where exactly? Donaldson turned his screen around and pointed at the location. Do you know this place? The detective did. The first time he'd seen that address was on a business card. A business card that a young man without socks had excitedly handed to him years ago. It was the address of the head office of Mundial magazine. If that's where Sam's phone was, the chances were that the killer was there as well. Ellis, gasped Wilson. At that moment, there was a bang on the door and the five men jumped. Open up, please, came a voice that Wilson had heard earlier that day. Detective Lloyd Hughes had tracked him down. Wilson's next move. Does he ramble on or mend fences? You decide. Thank you, Flo. Lovely to chat.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Susie.
Cheers.
And thank you, Barry.
Thanks, everyone.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.